Good morning. How are we? Everybody well?
We are
okay. We speak on behalf of the whole. Excellent. The royal we. Excellent. So this week we turn to Parashat Truma. Excellent. Still on the top of the sheet. Excellent. So in the last 2 weeks we have made some dramatic turns in the biblical text. We have, since creation, been following a narrative from Adam through the generations to Noah, through the generations to Abraham and his children, and their children, and their children, and Moses and the Exodus. There has been a straightforward flow of information, of narrative, of moral modeling. And then last week we hit a body of law. We get, after Revelation at Har Sinai, Parashat Yitro, we have Mishpatim, all the civil laws that ensure civic peace, a couple of ritual notes, and then we turn to Parashat Truma. What is Parashat Truma about? The Mishkan. Its instructions about building the Mishkan, about what's involved, the materials. What kind of materials are involved? Gold, silver, copper, acacia wood. What was the
cedar
trees? You have fabrics and curtains and dyes and colors and gemstones. It is aesthetically an exquisite description of a magnificent spiritual edifice. And I should note, I don't have to note, I guess I will note, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, as I've mentioned on a couple of occasions, has the great luxury of being able to drop names of people that he's encountered. And when you're chief rabbi, you get to do that. And he's noted that for a while he had a weekly learning session with Tony Blair. Anyone know the name Tony Blair? Oh, all right. Who's the prime minister now?
Boris.
Who was the last one? There we go. Right, I knew that. Right, okay. People aren't really usually that on top of who the prime minister is unless they're in the news. Theresa May was the answer to that. Yeah, how quickly one is forgotten in the world of politics. Yeah, who? It's tough. Right, so Tony Blair, why does everybody know Tony Blair? He was a while ago. Who was before Tony Blair? I mean, correct, as William Gladstone was, but it wasn't just before Tony Blair. Who was just before Tony? No, she was a way back. Who was right before? I'm willing to bet a lot of money nobody knows.
Cameron.
Okay, I'm about to withdraw because I heard somebody say it. I will no longer make that bet.
Cameron.
No, he was after Tony Blair.
John Major.
Even now that I've said that, many of you are like, oh, all right, I don't know who that is. Right, so in politics it can be. But somehow you'll know Tony Blair. Is it because of the Iraq War? Short name. He was articulate. He was an outspoken figure. He led a somewhat revolution, almost like Bill Clinton, who redefined what the Labour Party was, moved it towards the centre. And he was very close with George Bush, I think. And they used to appear together a lot, at least in the satirical comedies that made fun of them. Either way, so he used to learn with Tony Blair, he said regularly, and he said they used to have Bible study. He would go and they would learn some of the portion together. And at one point, Tony Blair said to him, look, Jonathan, because he could get away with that, what are we going to do with the boring parts of the Bible? And what did Rabbi Sacks say? Which one? So that's his joke. But Tony Blair was talking about this. You have major movie pictures made of the Exodus. This book is called Exodus. The Exodus is done. We have 12 parashas. After a third of them, we're out. And we spend the rest. Two-thirds of the book of Exodus is about building, measurements, materials, construction. And you've got a little bit of drama will return soon. Quite a major bit of drama, which is the golden calf. We have two parshas dedicated to the Mishkan and the vestments of the Kohanim. We then have a little bit of an intercession to talk about the golden calf. And then we have two more that repeat again all the details we're about to read in the next 2 weeks. So the question is, what do we do with the boring parts? And of course, the contention of our commentators will be that this is not boring. But the question, of course, will be, why? Why is this here? Which book of the five books of Moses would you say is most appropriate to the priestly world, to the world of the temple? Vayikra, that's where we've got all the korbanot. Why is this here? Why is this in the book of Shemot? Why is this in Exodus? Why does it matter right now for the story of our emancipation, for liberty, to start talking about the Mishkan? That's the question.
The classic Pesach story from Shibud to Mitzrayim, Shibud to God.
Interesting. Meaning this is perhaps to rebuff the words of the Rasha at the Seder. What does the Rasha say, essentially? He says, you were slaves to Pharaoh, and now you're slaves to God. What difference has this whole been about? You know, for this I left Egypt, what is this about? And the answer is that, no, you are not slaves to God, but yes, you are servants to God. This was not freedom, go and, you know, frolic in the wilderness. This was, you're free from slavery to Pharaoh, to a human master, but you have now a mission in service to God. So we have to have the Mishkan because it resembles your commitment, devotion, and service. Okay, that's one possibility. Excellent. One of the Ranbuz, the Ramban, correct, Nachmanides. Happy birthday to Ellie Brown, everybody. Yes, indeed. Well done. That was a very fashionable entrance there. Fashionably late. Fashionable too. I don't want to take that away from you. The Ramban, Nachmanides. Correct. Which now we have to ask a question. Nachmanides says the whole point of the Mishkan is essentially a portable Sinai. It is to encapsulate everything that took place on Mount Sinai, the intimacy with God, the revelation, the awe, the power, the election of the Jewish people, and to carry that with us, to keep that experience fresh and alive, because if it's just a memory, it can dissipate over time. And in fact, there are those who look back at Parashat Yitro and see the description of revelation itself as evocative of the Mishkan. There is the Kodesh Kodashim on top of the mountain. There are those who are allowed to come up partially up the mountain. Those who are left out. There's three stages in the same way that the Mishkan had three sections. And they go into immense detail. Rabbeinu Bachai and others describe revelation essentially as patterned after what the Mishkan will look like, or vice versa. So that's one view. And that fits very nicely with the text, because last week we did the laws that flowed from Har Sinai, and now we have the Mishkan to contain that experience. Anyone know another view of why we have this? Yeah.
According to the Rambam.
The Rambam, the other run.
To wean the people away from idolatry.
Okay, interesting. So this brings us back, we mentioned last week, Maimonides. I can't remember how it came up, talking about Korbanot and Maimonides last week. Oh, because we began talking about the opening of Mishpatim and how it seems to endorse slavery. So the Rambam's view in the Guide to the Perplexed. Anybody perplexed? Anyone in search of a guide? So in his Guide to the Perplexed, he suggests that many of the Jewish rituals, many of the biblical rituals, were designed to wean a people who were in a cultish world away from idolatry. And there are a few examples of this. Last week we said that slavery was one of those examples where it had to be included to kind of wean people off an ancient practice. And others have picked that up in the modern age as being the case. Korbanot, he says, the whole idea that I would take an animal and slit its throat and not eat a lot of it and kind of burn it on an altar to a god that doesn't need to eat was just a concession to the ancient world. That's Maimonides has that view with Korbanot. He has that with other things as well. One example, a lot of it is polemic. Anyone familiar with the word polemic? It's thrown around a lot. Polemic essentially means it's an argument against somebody else. It's not about essentially having a point. One example is, we'll get to in Vayikra, salt. There's an obligation to salt sacrifices. Why? God's got particular taste Says, I need salt. There's always like a salt shaker on the table. Some people like a lot of salt, so you put it out. God likes salt. What do you need the salt for? Say again?
Get out the blood.
Why do you want to get out the blood? I'm not eating it. I'm sprinkling blood all over the altar. It's not like there's an aversion to blood. So one view is that it stops the meat from putrefying and you don't want a horrible smell in the temple. But the Rambam, Maimonides says, it is because in the ancient world it was anathema to salt your korbanot because it took the blood away from the gods. It was saying, I'm going to take this away from you. So they refused to salt it because they wanted it to be entirely to the gods. So Kadosh Baruch Hu says, you salt the korbanot to make sure people understand I'm not eating this. This is not for me. I'm making a concession. They need to give sacrifices. They need rituals. They understand this is how religion works. But I need to subtly tell them this is not for me. Shatness. Why are we not allowed to wear shatness? So really, we're not told the reason. But Maimonides likes to present some reason. He says because in the ancient world, cults used to wear shatness and we needed not to do that. Kilayim in other contexts as well. So Rambam has this across the board. And in terms of the Mishkan, I can't remember if he says this explicitly, but it fits with his profile that the ancient world could not cope with an abstraction, so they needed to have some sort of house for God. Which leads us, in a moment, to why this parsha is not just a shift in the text, but theologically radical in a way that troubles a lot of people. But first I'll give you Rabbi Sack's answer that he gave to Tony Blair, which he then wrote a book about and published a book. You can go and buy it on all good Amazon websites and elsewhere. And he claims that it became government policy in England. I don't know if that's the case. It's called The Home We Build Together. Anyone seen this book, heard of this book? The Home We Build Together. And his argument was that why is it in Exodus? Not because it completes our journey to serve God, not because people needed to be weaned away from it, not because we're continuing Har Sinai per se contained here, but because this is part of what it means to achieve freedom. It's in the book of Exodus, in the book of Shemot, which is a book about liberty and freedom and society formation. And he says that if you just give people freedom, there's nothing to hold them together. And he's actually, if you want to save yourself reading the book, there's a 5-minute YouTube video called, I think it's called The Home We Build Together. You can watch. It's done by Whiteboard Animation, which does these drawings with words. You can have a look. 5 minutes saves you reading the whole book. And he makes a claim that this was written again 10 years ago when there were big statements made by a number of nation state heads in Europe saying multiculturalism has failed. Anyone familiar with the term multiculturalism? So Rabbi Sacks paints the history of the last 200 years. Before 200, 300 years ago, mass immigration movements were not that common. So if you were in England, most of the people around you were English. In Germany, most of the people around you were Germanic. Again, Germany wasn't a country. It was a bunch of principates 200 years ago, but most of the people were from there. Jews were exceptional in the sense that they were exceptional, of course, but they were exceptions in the sense that they were persecuted and chased around and moved about and didn't always feel rooted. And despite that, you have Jews who feel like they're Litvaks because they were from there, and they're Romanians because they were from there, and they were German Jews, and you have this sense. But people had this for a long time. Calm the Industrial Revolution, mass migration movements, huge nation states building armies and conquests and empires. You have mass movements of migration. And European countries had to figure out, what do we do with people who migrate into our countries? How do we assimilate them? And I know in the Jewish colloquial vocabulary, assimilation is a bad word. It means, well, we're losing everything. From a national state standpoint, assimilation is how we want people to become part of the fabric of society. So what do they do? So Rabbi Sacks paints them a number of models. One model was the country house model. Anyone seen, what's it called? The show about the British people in the posh house. They made a very dramatic movie. Thank you, Downton Abbey. I only saw the first season, and then people started dying every 3 seconds for no good reason, and it was just too much drama. It was too much drama. Anyone see Downton Abbey?
Yes.
Did you watch more than the first season?
Yes.
Oh, don't tell me what happened then. But I'll guess they all died.
No.
All right, most of them died.
No.
All right, 50% of them died. Yeah, they did. All right, fine. They just made a movie this year. I saw a review of it which said the whole stakes, the whole tension of the movie is the Queen is coming to visit.
Yeah, it's not.
That's not a high drama. He said, I think I saw it in a Jewish review that said basically the whole movie was about cleaning for Pesach. It was just cleaning and tidying and moving. That was the whole movie. And then she turns up. But either way, I've not seen it. Either way, Downton Abbey is the image of a country house. Where if you go to stay at Downton Abbey, where do they put you? In one of the guest rooms. And it's very pleasant. You feel welcomed and warm and served. You have staff that wait upon you who live downstairs. But it's not your home. It's not your place. You're a guest. And initially, the model that some European countries had was the country home. You're welcome here as our guests. But it's our country. It's our culture. You get to benefit from our services. But you are guests. You're not part of the fabric of society. That was just how nation states functioned. We need to maintain our culture, but you can come in as our guests. And he said that that leads to alienation. People don't really become part of the nation state. People don't associate with, they don't feel responsible. Why should I fight in your army? Why should I be part of the civil service? Why should I contribute? Meaning, this has nothing to do with me. I'm a guest. And you just take advantage of services that wasn't productive. He said a new model came about, which is called the model of the hotel. And the hotel was, everyone has their own room. Everyone has their own space, and the public spaces are nobody's. They don't have a culture. This was multiculturalism, and he claimed that, so what happened, all the important stuff that matters to people takes place in people's rooms, and the hallways become empty, and the country becomes empty, and it starts to kind of float in some aimless world without a culture, without a mission, without a cohesive body. Everyone just gets services and has all the important stuff in their rooms. And he says that started to fall apart and we need a new model. And he said the new model is the home we build together, which is, he basically argued in simple terms, for shared common social projects, where you have to come together and build a town hall together, or fix a bridge together, or just do something together that we can all feel like we've contributed in a public space as part of one whole in a way that doesn't compromise who we are. Now, apparently that became government policy. I don't know what that means, but that's what he said. And it's an interesting argument. It's a whole book, but again, it's a 5-minute video, and I basically summarized it for you. I've not read the whole book, but I have watched the whole video. So there might be more in there. That's worth looking at, and I'm sure there is. So Rabbi Sacks gave that answer to Tony Blair. That's why the building of the Mishkan is in Shemot, because you can be made free, you can be set free, your chains can be cast off, but if you don't come together to build something as a shared project, to look on with pride, everybody contributes in their own way, with their own resources, with their own ideas, everybody comes together, that forges a society that is not just free and aimless, but has a mission and is driven. And that's why it's here, not as a technical, we couldn't really fit it all into Vayikra, that would have been too lopsided, some of it's here. But this is part of what it means to be a nation. When we get to Vayikra, we'll talk about some of the rituals and spiritual life, but this is not about spiritual life per se, this is about building a nation. That's his argument. Now, that was Rabbi Sacks, which is a fascinating idea. Now, if you have a look, at the bottom of page one, the Givat Shaul reads the top. Let's look at the top of the page, the pasuk. This is the pasuk we'll put under. Oh, I'll explain who the Givat Shaul was. First, yes, a neighborhood. I don't know if it was named for him. I doubt it. So have a look at the top of the page of the pasuk. This is the pasuk we'll put under pressure. Then we're going to look at the Givat Shaul. We'll give an overview of things that come up in the parasha, and then we'll come back to the pasuk. Dabar al b'nei Yisrael. What's the opening pasuk to this week's parasha? Vaydabar Hashem Moshe Lemo. Okay, straightforward pasuk. We'll put that under pressure another time. Second pasuk. Dabar al b'nei Yisrael. Speak to the children of Israel. This is God speaking to Moshe. Speak to the children of Israel. V'yikchu li truma. And take to me, for me, truma. What is truma? Yes. gifts. Where else does truma come up in halachic life? You have to take truma from something? To the kohanim. The priests get truma. But truma in this context is not talking about from grain. It's talking about give me gifts or something special, a portion. Me'et kol ish asher yidevenu libo, from each person which has a volunteering heart, tikhu et trumati, take my gifts. Now, there are a couple of questions. We can ask all the questions. You know what? Let's ask all the questions. What about this pasuk is not clear? What seems extraneous? What seems redundant? What seems excessive? If you were rewriting this pasuk, if God said, I'm paying by the letter, I need to be brief, I need to be clear, how would you change this? Dabel b'nei Israel, speak to the children of Israel. We're also looking for lack of clarity or inconsistency. Again, just ostensibly, how it appears. Dabel b'nei Israel, v'ikhu li truma, take to me gifts. So how would you have said, if you were writing this and you were God, how would you have written it? You wouldn't say v'yikhu li truma. What might you say? V'yitnu li, right? Give me gifts. That seems like a better turn of phrase. Take to me gifts. Should be v'yitnu li truma. Speak to the children of Israel and tell them, give me gifts, okay? Me'et kol ish asher yidvenu libo, from each person who has a giving heart or wants to volunteer. Okay, what's these words suggesting? It's voluntary, it's not mandatory, it's not for everybody. There seems to be a lot of pressure put here in this word. We'll come to see in a minute. Tikhu et trumati, take my gifts. It seems to be completely superfluous. We've just said, v'yichu li trumati, tikhu et trumati. Why do we need that twice? So we're going to come back to a number of these questions, but the main one I want to turn to right now is again the expression, v'yichu li truma, take gifts for me. There's going to be a number of different ways to read this. If you look, there's a book, a sefer called Likute Batar Likute, or Likute Basar Likute, depending on how you pronounce your suffs or your tufts. I didn't want you to think it was about meat, though. So it's not Likute Basar Likute. And what does Likute mean? Connection, anthology. So it means basically a big anthology. And it was written actually by, or it was, let's say, put together by a figure who became the chief rabbi in, talking of the democratic debate, Cuba. He was the chief rabbi in Cuba at one point. And he put together, I think he may even have been buried in Cuba. He spent some time living in New York. Name is escaping me, but I can find it for you. Likutei Batar Likutei. And he takes pasuk by pasuk, and he says, these are the various commentaries on this pasuk. And it's usually the more, outlandish isn't the word, but the more intriguing readings. It's not just like Rashi, Ramban, Rashbam, Radat. He says, this is maybe what Rashi says, and this is what the Hasidic readings have, and this is an interesting reading that the Malbim has, of course, and various alternatives. And here, on Vayichu Li Truma, he has about 3 pages dedicated, and he begins, a lot of people ask, why doesn't it say Vayitnu Li Truma? And he says, we'll come back to some of them in a minute, but the Givat Sha'ul I want to turn to for a moment, because he is not in that collection, and you have to have found him to see this, and how I came by him is interesting. Emergency? Good. Givat Sha'ul, Rabbi Saul Levi Mortiera, I actually mentioned him on Shabbos in the Drasha, lived in Amsterdam, and very interesting figure. His student in his young age was, and remember, Baruch or Benedict Spinoza was his student. Anyone heard about Spinoza? I'm sure many of you have heard the name. He was what is called the first atheist in Europe. Not the first Jewish atheist in Europe, the first atheist in Europe. Though others, I'm sure, lived lives that were not observant. There were many others who had complications with their doctrine and their dogma and their faith. But he was the first European figure to say, I am not associated with any faith. Because in Europe, you were either a Catholic or a Protestant or a Jew. You weren't just a person. And he was the first to say, I don't want any of those labels. I'm Benedict Spinoza. I'm writing political commentaries. I'm writing political treatises and theological treatises, but I'm no longer bound by faith. Baruch Spinoza was then excommunicated by the Jews of Amsterdam, including his teacher, Rabbi Saul Levi Mortiera. Now, Saul Levi Mortiera, Amsterdam is a fascinating, has a fascinating history. Other than waiting only 1 hour after meat, they have a lot going for them. My sister married a Dutchman. Is that the right phrase? Yeah, not a Hollandman, a Dutchman. So she waits 1 hour now after meat. Don't worry, she has other chumras to make up for it. But don't take it personally. But Amsterdam was a fascinating community because a lot of the Jews who were expelled from Portugal and Spain ended up in Amsterdam. Amsterdam was an incredibly, and I don't want anyone who doesn't like this term to get bristled by it because it has a different meaning back then, but it was an incredibly liberal city. It was the first city that essentially embraced tolerance for different faiths and said, you can live here as long as you contribute to the society. You can practice how you want. You can live how you want. You can be proud Jews, proud Christians. I'm not suggesting there wasn't animosity between faiths, but at least governmentally. In theory, it embraced this idea of liberal democracy before anybody else, essentially. Amsterdam, fascinating place. And a lot of the Jews who ended up in Amsterdam were actually what... Say again?
New Christians.
Right. What's the term for this? The not pleasant term? Moranos. Yeah, what are you talking about?
I was just in Portugal. They actually converted.
Oh, you were.
To being Christian. They were new Christians. They were not Moranos.
What's the difference you're making?
Morano is a converse, and Morano is like sort of like a slur, basically. So they call them anasim or something like that. So
right, and new Christians, meet people who happily converted, you think? I see, okay. Right, so they both converted Moranos and new Christians, but the claim is that Moranos did it under duress and lived secret Jewish lives, and the new Christians kind of embraced it. And did they return to Judaism? Okay, so I guess it wasn't duress in the sense that they felt persecuted and continued to live as Jews, but it was not freely accepted in the sense that they found the light and went to Christianity. They thought, oh, it'll be easier, I'll just live this way. And then when they got free, they found their way back. So it's actually interesting. I've not seen any studies on this. I've just heard anecdotal evidence about some of the Hispanic communities in South America, which extends up to America as well. There are a lot of families who on Friday night light candles, and they don't know why. Right, they go down to the basement to light candles. They say, my grandmother always did this. Her mother always did this. They told us to light candles. And my understanding is a lot of these communities have descended from the Morano communities that... There's currently 100,000? That sounds like a lot. Let's sign them up as members. Let's do it.
They say 20% of the Latino population has Jewish roots.
Could be. There's this program on TV, Finding Your Roots. They should do a mass version and see where we end up. All right, yeah, fascinating. So in Amsterdam, all these figures, not all, a lot of the community was made of Moranos who, for the first time in two generations, felt like, oh, I don't have to do it in the basement. I don't have to pretend. I can come out and be Jewish. But after two generations, one's sensibilities are shifted a lot. What's acceptable is shifted a lot. If you don't live Jewish observant lives, ritual, you don't wear tefillin very often, and you don't really keep kosher, and then suddenly you've got a rabbi saying, you can't eat this, and you can't have that, and you've got a hefshek for this, and you can't do that on Shabbat. They're like, well, ease up. Ease up. I want to be true to my roots. We light candles Friday night. I'd like to do that upstairs in the window rather than in the basement, but don't come at me with all this stuff. So Rabbi Mortiera was in a position where he had to try to find his way to not bash Christianity, but find ways to make Jewish life seem like true civilization. And even though that these rituals seem cumbersome and burdensome, but they're deeply meaningful, and that they've been the tradition for thousands of years, and you were unfortunately persecuted out of them, but you should do them again. So he was in an interesting position. Rabbi Mortiera was in a position in a shul for, I think, 25, 30 years. Givat Shaul, Saul Levi, so Givat Shaul is the hills of Saul, is a volume of 50 of his sermons that they published. Now, he took the position that every year he was going to base his drasha on one pasuk in the parasha. And his first year as rabbi, he used the first pasuk of the parasha. Second year as rabbi, he used the second pasuk in the parasha. The third year, and he went through. And I don't know how good they all were, but they picked the top 50, one from each parasha, and they published it. And they're pretty good. So I imagine the years when it was Vayidbar Hashem Moshe Lemor, for the fifth time in a different parasha, they're like, oh, good luck, rabbi. And I came by this in graduate studies. I had to do four qualifying exams, and one of them was on medieval Jewish preaching. And he was often medieval Jewish preaching, but I started with him and I worked my way back. There's a fellow, Mark Saperstein, who wrote a book, Jewish Preaching 1200 to 1700, where he traces through. And Rabbi Mortier was one of his specialty figures, and he does a lot of studies on him. And he talks about drashas generally, Mark Saperstein. Interesting fellow. He wrote an essay about 10 years ago saying, is the Jewish sermon on its deathbed? You can tell me better than I can. I have to do it, but you have to hear it. So he wrote a piece about that. Interesting. Either way, Rabbi Mortier says, what does this pasuk mean? Vayikhu li truma. He says, it doesn't mean give me gifts. It means take from me something. And he says, truma doesn't mean gifts. What's the root of truma here? What's the three-letter root?
Donate.
Well, litrom usually means to donate, but what's the root, the three-letter root? Resh, vav, mem. Rome. What does Rome mean? Not Rome, the city. Rome means to... Romamut means elevated. So it means to elevate. Sometimes it means to separate. That's why truma means... Litro means to set aside or to give over. But Rome means elevation. And here, Rabbi Mortier said, Vayikhu li truma is a Kodesh Baruch Hu saying to the Jewish people, take from me my Romamut. Take some of that transcendence away from me. Meaning, build a house for me. This is where theological problems come up. We've just been told that Jewish life is radically different to the cults of the ancient Near East. That all this idolatry, all these polytheistic cultures need to be pushed aside for the revelation of a new doctrine, of a new God that is one and whole and abstract and uncontainable. And now we're told, oh, by the way, build me a house and cut up meat for me and burn incense for me and don't let anybody into the middle room. I mean, it sounds like Wizard of Oz, right? What does this sound? It's that, hold on a minute. You've just taken us out of a place where they worship different gods and they have temples. And you said, we're doing something new. We have a God who has no name, who is the beneficent figure beneath the entirety of the cosmos, and now you're telling me build him a house? This is astonishing. Why? Why is he saying build me a house? Now, for Rashi, he says the chronology is completely off here. Rashi says even though we haven't had the golden calf yet, this whole parasha comes after the golden calf. Why it's out of order, you'll have to ask him or look into the commentaries. But he says this is out of order. After Revelation, God had no intention of there being a Mishkan. After giving us the Torah, the intention was, you're an intelligent people, you're a sophisticated civilization, take this law, build a society, and worship me. That's the end of it. But then they turned to a golden calf, and God realized, so to speak, what did he realize? The people can't cope with those levels of abstraction. People can't cope with those levels of abstraction. I worship this. I need something. I need something concrete, even if it's not what I worship, just to resemble what I worship, to house my ideas. And Rashi says, essentially, the Mishkan was a concession. At the dawn of time, this was in God's mind because he knew what was going to happen, but this was not the ideal state. The ideal state was there won't be a temple, there won't be a Mishkan, but we'll just have this abstract recognition of an ethereal God. But then after the golden calf, there was this recognition that a people, a society, can't always cope with abstraction and needs something concrete. Now, does this sound like another faith in any way? Or maybe it didn't, but maybe it does now that I've asked that question. Right, Christianity made a very different, complicated, but on the surface similar claim that they needed to have an incarnation of God in order for humanity to cope. There's a lot more complexity to their theology than that. But on some level, it sounds like this is a similar concession. And in some ways, the answer is yes, but not in a human form. And here's what the Givat Shaul is saying. V'yikhu li truma, this is whether it was before or after the golden calf. The Givat Shaul is suggesting again to his audience of Moranos that Judaism doesn't think you have to stretch up into the cosmos. There are ways to concretize our religious ideology. We have an ark, we have a Sefer Torah, we have a Bima, we have ritual life to help us contain our theology in a human way so that we can worship God. V'yichu li truman, his words, look at the bottom. And it's not just that it's too abstract, but when it becomes abstract, what happens? If God is too remote, if God is too distant, too abstract, too unattainable, too undescribable, what happens to our relationship with God? It weakens. It fades. It's okay, I can't relate to this being, I can't really speak to this being, I cannot begin to conceive of why this being cares about the kind of car I have, or what my paycheck looks like, or what my health condition. He's dealing with the cosmos. It's so remote. And here, the Givat Shaul says, Hasibah ha'atzmit, the most powerful cause, the kfirat ha'ashgacha b'tachtonim, for the heretical rejection of providence, v'yaminu b'ramam to, is just a belief in God's ultimate transcendence. If you believe that God is this being of ultimate transcendence who can't affect, who doesn't live in this material cosmos in a real way, so he's not caring for how I live, if I trip, if I stub my toe, if I hurt myself, if something wonderful happens, I don't connect that to God, he's too removed. Lachain amar, so God said, v'yikhu li truma, klomar, which means, yikhu mimenu haromamot hazot, take from me this level of transcendence. Ki gam b'shfalim ani mashiach, because I'm also involved with the world down here. So the temple, the Mishkan, is not, perhaps not just a reaction to the betrayal of the golden calf, but it is intentional. And it's different to Rabbi Sacks. Rabbi Sacks says this is about building a society, and God is almost peripheral to this activity. God comes with revelation. He gives us the law, and the Mishkan is basically a way to bring us together, but the actual building doesn't matter so much. And here the suggestion is actually this is incredibly theologically powerful because it makes contact with God direct, and it puts him literally in the middle of the camp. And everyone knows, not everybody, but many know the pasuk, Asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham. Build for me a mikdash, a sanctuary, God says in this week's parsha, v'shachanti b'tocham, and I will dwell among them. And what is the famous Dvar Torah that it always said about this? Build for me a mikdash, and it should have said v'shachanti b'tocho, and I will dwell in it. But it doesn't say that. God says, build me a mikdash and I will dwell b'tocham in them. So what's the Dvar Torah?
That this is right. With each other, with God as a part of the ingredient.
Right, meaning you build a mikdash, that's not for me to live in. I don't need a house, I don't need a roof, I don't need walls, I don't need security. I'm fine on my own. Build me a house, why? So that I can live in you. The whole point of this is so that I can live in your lives. What's the pshat, by the way, of that pasuk? Is it just impossible to render that pasuk literally? I mean, I don't think so. The pshat is God says, build me a mikdash for shechani b'tocham, and I will be, and I'll be in the midst of you. Right? Meaning, build me a mikdash and I will be in the middle of the camp. Right? That's the pshat. But Chazal put it under pressure because it could have said v'shechanti b'tocho, and at least it has the insinuation that God is saying, and I will live in you. And here the suggestion he's making is if you make a concrete bet mikdash, yes, it looks like a concession to our theology because God doesn't need a temple, he doesn't need a house, doesn't need containing, doesn't need a plinth to sit on. But the mikdash is to make God part of our life. It is to fill providence in our minds. That's a Givat Shaul. Having said that, there is another view. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, in addition to saying that this is a continuation of Har Sinai, what he means by that is, this is not a concession, this is an ideal. So why do we have a Mikdash ideally? You've got the Givat Shaul saying because it brings God closer to us theologically. But the Ramban and all the mystics who follow him, and actually the most important Jew in history, the Malbim, not being fully mystical himself, but spent some time in doing mystics. I will I'll mention this Shabbat afternoon in a couple of weeks. He went through a lot of despair in his late teens. He was married at 14, had two children, and was divorced at 18, and then spent the next 12 years trying to find a wife and a job. And in his early 20s, he spent some time in a town called Zidichev. Anyone know Zidichev, the name? Anyone know what the Rebbe from the town was called? Zidichev a Rebbe, correct. Well done. And in Chicago, there are how many Zidichev a Rebbes? Well, three. You're close. Three Zidichev a Rebbes. Are they related? Yeah, they're all cousins. Eichenstein, I think is the name, Rabbi Eichenstein. There are three Eichensteins, and they're all kind of the Zidichev a Rebbe. And the Malbim went to Zidichev, and he learned with the first Zidichev a Rebbe, who was a mystic. And he got a lot of mystical training there. Either way, in his commentary to this part of Shmot, the Malbim has a separate section. He's got his regular commentary, and then there's a special section called Ramazei HaMishkan, the hints of the Mishkan. And he suggests that actually, building off the Ramban, he pushes away and he rejects Rambam, Maimonides reading the Mishkan. He says, every aspect, we have parsha after parsha, pasuk after pasuk after pasuk, describing the Mishkan. Let's say you're Rabbi Sacks, and imagine that for a moment. You're Rabbi Sacks, and the whole point of this is that we need to build something together. How many psukim would it take to give me that message?
One.
Yeah, one, less than one. Right, and build me, asuli mikdash v'shechandi b'docham, chazak chazak v'nit chazek, into Vayikra. I need to hear what material was used, how long the wood was, how long it took to put it up, what order they put it up in. You need to give me all this detail. Leave that for the oral law. Give me a tradition. Let me ask you a question. How do we do Shechita? Are there any conditions to Shechita? There are some that I'm sure everybody knows. What's one condition of Shechita? Say again?
You have to be observant.
Oh, okay. So it has to be a kosher animal. Level of observance might be important.
Short knife.
Knife. I mean, number one, let's start. You need a knife. Right, we all assume, obviously you need a knife, but shechita just means kosher death of an animal. Right, you have to kill it with a knife. You can't use, what do they use? Stun gun with nails, and it's not more humane. I mean, let's be honest, an animal's being killed. None of this is happy days. But there are humane-er ways, but still an animal's being killed. Either way, it has to be a knife. There are other instances. Another one is, there are five rules of Shechita. One of them is, you can't push towards the neck. So how do you cut it without pushing towards it? You just have to do horizontal motion. One of the reasons that the knife is incredibly sharp is because you can't put any upward pressure. Or, I don't know if any of you have seen this, in abattoirs or what you call slaughterhouses, often the cow is upside down. They have them upside down in these harnesses because it's easier to shecht that way. Firstly, you don't have to put downward pressure. You just have this incredibly sharp knife and you just go back and forth in it. Yeah, I don't imagine it's fun for the cow. I can't imagine the right way up or upside down is fun. Either way, so you can't put downward pressure. Has anyone ever seen these shechita knives? I've seen them. I've not held any, but I've been told by friends and peers that it is so sharp. He said he was holding one at one point, and then his hand just felt warm, and he wasn't sure why, and he looked down, and he was just bleeding like crazy, because it's so sharp, you don't even feel it. That's how sharp it is. You don't feel the cut. I think I may have told you in the past, actually, about a shochet from Israel who went to South America, Argentina, to shecht some of the animals to get the hindquarters that we don't really do elsewhere. Did I tell you this?
No.
So he went to go. He traveled with his shechita knives. This is a story I heard. I can't give you any more verification. He arrived in the airport and they said, what on earth is this massive pack of 20 sharp knives? And his facility was English was not great. He only spoke Hebrew. So he said to them, I kill for the Jews. Yeah. So they had to get some translators in to say he kills animals for the Jews, just to make that clear. Right, so there are rules for Shechita. Again, I have to follow my breadcrumbs back. There are rules to Shechita. Are they in the Torah? No, it says, Kashet Siva, as I've commanded you. Where did God command us? This is one of those verses that indicates there is an oral body of law, because it doesn't give me the details of how to do Shechita. It says, do Shechita as I've commanded you. How did you command me? And the oral law says, here, this is how God commands us. There are oral traditions. That's one of the psukim that indicates unequivocally that there's an oral tradition. There are others. Tefillin. What does tefillin look like? I mean, how do you see them? What color are they?
Black.
Black. Do they have to be black? You ever seen anyone with pink tefillin or green tefillin or orange tefillin?
Yes.
Oh, really? Oh, maybe you have. Right, so they're not kosher tefillin from, let's say, an Orthodox halachic standpoint. I'm sure, the truth is, I'm sure there are multicolored rainbow tefillin somewhere. But from a halachic traditional standpoint, they have to be black. Does the Torah say they have to be black? Does the Torah say they have to be boxers? Does the Torah say they have to have straps? It doesn't say anything. It says you have to have a sign between your eyes and on your arm. What does that mean? That's where you have the oral law to say. Say again. So luckily there is another verse that says you can't have tattoos, which we can talk about when we get later down. But it's very unclear. And in fact, some of the Pashtanim, some of the literal commentator, the medieval age, Radak, says, what does it mean, sign between your eyes? He says, it's a metaphor. You have to have it between your eyes all the time, the memory of what happened. That's the pshat. And he says, and the drush is, this is talking about tefillin. There are 10 rules about tefillin to make them kosher, and they are all halacha l'Moshe Mitzrayim, which means they are traditions, we assume, that were not interpreted by the sages, but were given to Moses on Mount Sinai. They are indisputable. That's the assumption about tefillin. So, I say all this to say, if the whole Mishkan was just to bring us all together, could have said, Asule mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham. Build me a mikdash, and I'll dwell there. What are the details? It's in the Talmud. It's in the oral law. I don't need to give you all the details. That could quite easily be the case. The Ramban and others say, it can't be that we have four parshas, hundreds of psukim dedicated to this edifice in every detail, every regulation, every material, every measurement, just to make this point for government policy in 2012. That can't be what this is about. There must be meaning in every measurement, in every material, in every angle, in every placement. And that's where you have the Ramban, and the Malbim goes full on with this. Every part of the Mishkan is bursting with symbolism. And actually the Malbim goes into great detail about how the Mishkan resembles the human body, or how the human body resembles the Mishkan. It says the Kodesh Kodashim is the head. The Kodesh is the upper torso. And then the Chatzer is stomach and down. Now, what's in the Chatzer? The Mizbeach, where all the food is burned. That's the stomach, where you do digestion and things like that. Then you have the Kodesh, where you have the Shulchan and the Menorah. And another little Mizbeach. And the Shulchan and the Menorah, he says, are the lungs and the heart. And he goes into detail about that. The Kodesh, Kodoshim rather, what's in the Holy of Holies? The ark. What's in the head? The brain. What's inside the ark? Ten Commandments. How many tablets? Two. How many hemispheres? Two. He claims there are two hemispheres to the brain. Oh, hold on a minute. There's something else in the Aron Kodesh. What else is in the Aron Kodesh? The original Luchot that were crumbled and were underneath. The hippocampus. That's what he says. There are two hemispheres and there's the lower part of the brain. That's what that is. And he points out how many beams they are. He says that's the same number of human vertebrae. I'm not a doctor. I can't guarantee that's the case. But he goes into immense detail to claim that the Mishkan is essentially an Ish Gadol. It's just the blueprint of a human body, which is, on some level, makes you think, whoa, 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 are you just saying that this is a being that we're worshiping? And he says, no. And he has this, I don't want to go off, all right, we're off the beaten track. Anyone heard of monism? It's not people who like to moan. We don't need a movement for that. So monism is the belief, but there is a single material, let's say substance, a single substance that exists that is both material and spiritual. We all used to this division, there are material things and there are spiritual things. And what's the neshama? I don't know. It's a different realm. None to do with me. I'm in a physical body. I don't know where the neshama is. I can't point to it. I can't isolate it. It's metaphor, allegory. It's beyond me. So that's the division between materialism and spiritualism. Monists believe there is one substance, that, and material and spiritual is just on a spectrum. And if you believe this, if one has this view, which the Malbim seems to indicate he embraces, that means what I eat, when we say, oh, if you eat non-kosher, what does it do to you? Nothing. I mean, it has something to do with spiritual points in the world to come. So the claim of monists is, no, when you eat things, they are harmful to your soul. That doesn't just mean, oh, in the afterlife, the tally chart is moving, but actually it's doing something to your soul, which resides in your body, and it is affecting you as a being. The Malbim says that Giranasha can't be eating because it is the most dense sinew in the human body. It represents the depth of materialism, and if you were to eat that, it would somehow riddle your soul. And he writes about this in detail, and he says that actually the Mishkan is just resembles the human body in the same way that the cosmos resembles the Mishkan, in the same way that the universe resembles the universe. He's got all this reading of how the whole world functions along some spiritual lines where the Mishkan generates divine presence in the same way that human bodies can divine this, can bring the divine presence. It's a strange reading. We'll get to it. Strange just means it's unusual. It's not common. We'll read it in a few months, maybe a few weeks' time, Shabbat afternoon. Either way, he goes into a lot of detail about how the Mishkan, just based on the human body. And what this does, it justifies why we have four parashot describing each part of it. Now, having said that, there are others who don't go down the Malbim route on this and say, oh, that there are two hemispheres in the brain and there are two tablets of law. But there are those who say that there's a lot of symbolism here, and it's not incidental. And I'll give a couple examples. What comes up in this week's parasha? We have the Aron Kodesh. And how's the Aron Kodesh built? What does it look like? We're told that it's made of what material? Gold and wood. How is it made? Right, it's a wooden box that is given golden inlay and outlay on the inside and the outside. It's gold plated on both sides. If you were designing the ark and you were trying to be conservative with your material, but trying to give an impression, how would you say the ark should be? Let's say it's made of wood. Gold outside. Who's looking on the inside? No one is looking on the inside. Why is there gold on the inside? Say again?
For God.
For God. So what's the message? Okay, interesting. So those are two messages, right? One message might be, don't think because you don't see it, it's unimportant. There's theological significance to all that's hidden. God sees what we don't see. And there's a message there that there's gold on. Again, this is all because we're told how it was made. If it's just about bringing the people together, or it's just weaning people off idolatry, all these historical truths about how it was made are quite incidental. But if you say, no, this is inscribed in a divine document that is designed to be eternal, that captures eternal moral truth, why am I given details about wood and gold and size and cubits? But if you start saying that it is suffused with moral messages, then it becomes meaningful all of a sudden. And one reading might be there's God on the inside to teach us that what we can't see is still valuable. That could be done theologically or that can be done ethically. The suggestion being your inner world has to be reflective of your outer world. Don't be inauthentic. Don't be insincere. Don't live a life of external commitment and inside live a life of heresy or neglect. So that's an interesting reading. There's only one of the vessels, only one of the kelim that has partial measurements. Everything is 10 cubits by 3 cubits, 3 cubits by 5 cubits, apart from one that says it's 9.5. Which is the one that has a half measure? Give you a clue, we were talking about it a second ago.
The ark.
The ark, right. The Aron Kodesh is the only one with half measurements. Why? Because the moving company said, I only provide 5 boxes and this is how it's got to be. Alternatively, because transcendence, God is ultimately, at some level, incomprehensible. There's only partial understanding. There's only that half measure of comprehension that we can attain. Again, I'm not suggesting that these are incontrovertible theological truths, only to suggest that all these details deserve attention. and can provide moral insight. Now, we are out of time in a minute, by which I mean 10 minutes ago. So we're going to very quickly, just making sure I'm not missing a meeting. Okay, I hope not. So, page one. V'yichuli trumah, we're going to go through very quickly. Take for me gifts. We said that the Givat Shaul had this radical reading that says it's got nothing to do with gifts. It's God saying, take my transcendence from me. Make me in your life. That's one intriguing reading. Now, there are others. Now, if you have a look in the second box, the Hakatava Kabbalah, and we'll finish with this because otherwise, I'll tell you what, I'll say very briefly the third box, what people say. People suggest that this is not talking, it's not saying Moshe, tell the people, take for me gifts. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying to Moshe, Daber el b'nei Yisrael, not speak to the Jewish people, but speak to the elite of the people, the Yichuli Truma, and have them take gifts for me. Meaning, assemble a group of collectors. Which again is not to say, oh, God's installing a tax, but actually it's indicating some of the hardest thing to do. You can have the most impressive communal project, an idea, but if you don't have people to organize it, if you don't have people to put it together, it falls apart. I'm sure as Linda ran the shul for quite a while, we'll know that if you don't have volunteers, and many of you are volunteer for your organizations, for your shuls, at work, at home, if you don't put a team together to get it done, it doesn't happen. And at some other level, we could talk about this in the realm of politics. You can bash and yell and scream and you know, shout your ideas, but if you don't have to put a team together, if you don't have to enact it, your dreams fall apart. And here Kadosh Baruch Hu is saying, Dabel b'nei Yisrael, speak to them, v'yikhuli truman, have them take for me. If you don't have people to gather this in, you can go out there, Moshe, and say, we need to build a temple. And everyone say, yeah! Who's going to do it? I've just got to go for an appointment, right? Who's going to? You have to appoint people to put it together, which is not easy to do. And then the Abarbanel says, and the rest of the pasuk is instructions to these collectors about don't force anybody to take. Kol isha she'yidvenu libo, and it should be kol ish. It should be everybody. Don't just go to the wealthy and say, do you want to underwrite and we'll make this the, you know, the, I'm not going to say any names, I don't want to, we'll make this the X sponsored mikdash. This is everybody should be involved to the extent that they can. Make it willing. Kol yidvenu libo. Interestingly, tikhwe trumati, take for me, is in the plural, and suggestions here are that when it comes to communal finances, it should be tikhu. There should be more than one person. It shouldn't just be one person responsible for communal finances, because either the temptation will be too difficult, or it won't be above suspicion. You at least want to have you don't want to give the appearance of impropriety. So you need to have multiple people. A number of shuls insist on having two signatories. A number of businesses will have two signatories for things like that, which is very important. My father said in his shul, when he was the equivalent of president of the shul, the rabbi collected money for something, and he had my father sit in the office while he counted the money, just to show, look how much money I got, but to show, I'm not going to do anything on my own. I need people to understand that this is all above board. Either way, so that's that pasuk in that reading. And the second box is a radically different reading, which has become a platitude, but is intriguing. We're way over time. Who gives the ring in a Jewish wedding? The man gives the ring. What happens if the woman gives the ring? That's true. This has become a controversial political question about Jewish identity, because there's now this new practice. Some have, what's it called? Double ring ceremonies? That's what it's called? So again, it depends on which part of the community you're in. This is Chicago. This wasn't really happening in some segments. What is now called open orthodoxy, my understanding is this is regular practice. But again, you say it is what it is. Sometimes kids want to do things that parents don't agree with and it becomes contentious. But there is this new thing called double ring ceremonies, which most Orthodox rabbis in the RCA as an umbrella body has said we don't do under the chuppah. This is not Jewish practice because the man gives the ring. So what happens halachically if the woman gives the ring? Nothing, presumably. With one exception. Just let's start back. Why does nothing happen? What needs to occur for a Jewish wedding to... There needs to be some sort of acquisition on the part of whom... Well, the woman has to acquire the property, which solidifies the relationship that the man is then responsible for maintaining. So that was close. We nearly got into somebody acquiring a woman. So we're not going to go down that route, although Kenyan is used in this context. But she's the one who has to acquire the property as a solidification to the relationship that he then acquires the responsibility to maintain. Is that okay? Okay, good. As long as it was correct in some way, we're okay. So again, what needs to happen is she needs to acquire some object in order to solidify this relationship. So she can give a ring to a man, and what happens halachically? Nothing, because she didn't acquire anything. She wasn't given anything. There is one exception to this, which the Gemara in Kiddushin says, is if she gives a ring to an incredibly important man, and he takes it, it works. Why? Did she get anything? What did she get? She got the benefit of, wow, he accepted my ring. And that is a tangible benefit. It's, again, social capital, but it's tangible benefit and it works. Now, again, everyone's going to say, of course, my husband's the most important man in the world. Wait till they get home. We'll see who's the most important man in the world. But either way, that is an exception suggested. Again, we're not practicing this today, because again, who's going to say who's the most important thing, tangible benefit, whatever the case is. It's just used to exemplify here for the Ketava Kabbalah that it's not just a platitude that sometimes you get by giving. That sometimes when you give, you're actually receiving. And we use this as a platitude generally. I'm sure many of you have heard the anecdote told about Rothschild that everybody says that I'm about to say, that he was once asked by one of his peers, what's your net worth? He wrote down on a piece of paper and he gave it to him and he said, that can't be, that doesn't seem like, I've heard rumors that you have, wow. And he said, no, that's how much I gave in charitable giving last year. That's how much I'm worth. This is how much money I'm responsible for, but that's how much I'm worth. And again, it's a moving idea about what charity is, but the suggestion here is actually when you give, you get. And here when God said, Vayitchu li truma, take for me gifts, is to insinuate that you may be giving God these things, but actually you're getting something in return. You're getting the benefit of giving something that's being accepted by God. Rabbi Sachs' Parsha piece this week, Covenant Conversation, actually says you get something else. It's not just, oh, the benefit that this important figure or being took my things, but what do you get when you're in a position to give? Dignity. You get dignity. When you get to give, you get a sense of human dignity. And what have these Jews been doing for the last 300 years? They've been slaves. They don't have dignity. They don't have anything to give. And Rabbi Sachs argues that actually this is precisely, again, part of their freedom formation, is that they came out of Egypt, they were given law, and then they were told, now you need to be a people of givers. And some have read this as a test, meaning put your money where your mouth is. You just said, Naaseh v'nishma, oh, you're going to do everything? Pay up. And I've listened to Shirim where rabbis say, and then uses that to pivot. We have the dinner coming up, which, by the way, we do have the dinner coming up. And that you can say, Naaseh v'nishma, I'm in, I'm part of this. And then we say, okay, let's see if you put your money where your mouth is. And that's what this is. I'm not going to go down that route, which is my way of saying it without saying it. But Rabbi Sachs doesn't go, I wouldn't have mentioned it. Actually, Rabbi Sachs uses it in the context to say, this is not just about a test to put your money where your mouth is. This is actually about, again, nation building with a nation full of people who have the dignity of knowing what it means to give. And again, it's not saying you need to give a certain amount. God is saying, set aside what you can. And by giving, you achieve a certain sense of dignity. And again, I'm not in the research or the scholarship, my understanding is people who suffer from depression and other things, one of the, not always effective and not the only effective remedy, is to volunteer. Because when you feel like you are giving, you feel like you're important to other people, it gives you a sense of dignity and worth. And here the Jewish people are being told, become givers. And it's not easy. It's not easy to say, okay, I'll get dignity, I'll open my pocket, where's my dignity? It doesn't translate in that way. It has to be given from a sense of, I feel like I'm doing something that is purposeful and meaningful. And we're going to leave it there because we're over time. But I do wish you all a good Shabbos. We have the special... the photo is because it's given with love. There you go. As are all the shirim that I give. We have the immense privilege this Shabbos of having Rabbi Zatz here as a Skol in residence. I invite everybody to come, all his presentations. We'll be announcing the schedule, and we're all very much looking forward.